Radio Prague News.
The Czech Republic's prison system is on the verge of collapse, the justice minister has said. Illegal aliens in the Czech Republic will be able to join a voluntary return program as of September 2009. And the Czech Republic has won a 2 billion international arbitration case against the Luxembourg media company. The Czech Republic's prison system is on the verge of collapse, Justice Minister Daniela Kovářová told reporters on Wednesday. Czech prisons currently hold some 22,000 inmates, the highest number in nearly 10 years. Meanwhile, another 7,500 convicts have not yet started serving their sentences. If part of them commence serving them now, a crisis scenario would have to be put in place. Under these circumstances, inmates would have to be accommodated in areas that are not designed to that purpose, such as prison gyms, the head of the Czech prison service, Luděk Kula, said. The justice minister noted that Czech prisons were overcrowded and inaction could lead to the collapse of the whole system. Illegal aliens living in the Czech Republic will be able to join a voluntary return program as of September 2009, an Interior Ministry spokeswoman said on Wednesday. Until now, only foreigners with work permits could apply for such programs, which provide them with a free plane ticket home and financial assistance. Illegal aliens will, however, receive no subsidies from the state. In July and August, the Czech Interior Ministry will launch a campaign to inform people about the possibility. Those who apply will face no sanctions for illegally staying in the country. The People in Need NGO estimates that around 300,000 illegal aliens are currently living in the country. The Czech Republic won a 2 billion international arbitration case against the Luxembourg media company, a Czech finance ministry spokesman told journalists on Wednesday. The Luxembourg-based firm European Media Ventures demanded some 2 billion crowns, or more than $107 million, in compensation for their lost investment in a TV station in the Czech Republic. The case is the second international arbitration the country has won in recent weeks. The Czech Republic, however, still faces around 10 such cases involving some 20 billion crowns, or more than $1 billion. Most of them deal with the alleged failure of Czech authorities to protect foreign investments. Canada granted asylum to 132 Czech nationals in 2008 and the first 4 months of 2009, the Četeka news agency reported on Wednesday, citing sources from the Canadian embassy in Prague. Canada's Immigration and Refugee Board dealt with 334 applications of Czech citizens over that period of time, which was only a fraction of the overall number of asylum seekers, nearly 3,000 applicants, mostly members of the Czech Republic's Romani community. The Czech Republic has become the second largest source of asylum seekers in the North American country after Mexico. Ottawa has been considering reinstating visas for Czech nationals as a result, but has not yet reached a final decision. And a quick look at the weather. The end of the week will be clouded with rain showers across most of the country. Highest day temperatures should range between 16 and 20 degrees Celsius. My name is Jan Richter, and that's the end of the news.
Hello, you're tuned to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, with me, Rosie Johnston. Coming up today, tenants of Prague's lost squat have been evicted. Should the state play any role in finding them new accommodation? We talk to the stars at this year's Karlovy Vary Film Festival, and Ivan Hašek names himself the new coach of the Czech national football team. Then later, a tragic communist figure killed by the regime he helped to create. In this week's Czechs in History, we look at the life of Rudolf Slánský.
He may have been, on occasion, perhaps even more important than Gottwald himself.
All that coming up later on, so be sure to stay tuned. It had been home to Prague's last remaining squat. Now it's lying empty, its future uncertain. The fate of the Milada Villa and of the small anarchist collective who'd been living in it has dominated headlines in the Czech media over the last few days since the last squatters were removed from the building. But an improvised plan to relocate the squatters has also ruffled feathers, as Rob Cameron reports.
The Milada Villa is a dilapidated pre-war building a few dozen metres from the banks of the River Vltava in Prague 8. Drivers heading north to Teplice might be able to spot it on the left as they cross the river in Holešovice, just next to a couple of tower blocks that serve as student dormitories. For the last 10 years, the building, administered by a state body called the Institute for Information in Education, has been home to the Milada commune of squatters. Before that, as the squatters frequently point out, it lay empty for about a decade. The decision to expel them was taken after a number of complaints from the students about noise and aggressive dogs. Last week, the Institute for Information in Education hired security guards to remove the squatters. Several of them decided to occupy the roof in protest, and the situation began to deteriorate. That was when the government's human rights minister, Mikhail Kotsab, stepped in. His spokeswoman, Leila Abbasova, explained his reasons for doing so.
Maybe I should tell you the whole story, you know, to really understand how Mr. Kotsab was included in the situation. In that afternoon, in the Tuesday afternoon, we were just bombarded, by phones from Milada, from the squatters, from the reporters, that the security company is trying to chase out the people, that it looks like that there might be some violent, even, you know, some injuries, even death, because there was raining, people were, you know, on the roof was broken. And there was also information that there are two or three buses coming with the supporters of squatters who might, you know, take the situation into their hands, you know, who knows how. So the whole solving of the situation was to do it very calmly and try to find the way out from it, try to find another place where they can, you know, stay.
Mr. Kotsab's solution arrived in the form of an offer from an old friend from the music business, a promoter turned businessman called Petr Svinka. He offered the squatters three flats and a basement in his apartment building in Truhlarska Street, right in the centre of Prague, for free until the end of the year. The squatters have since come down off the roof, moved into Truhlarska Street, and Milada can once again be used by the authorities. Problem solved. Or not, as it turned out. For a start, Petr Svinka's tenants are far from happy with their new neighbours, who've already hung anarchist flags and the like out of the windows. The tenants claim Mr. Svinka has ulterior motives. They say he's trying to get rid of them so he can demolish or rebuild the property. Here's what one had to say to Czech television.
What they want to do is demolish the building, you see, and lots of tenants have already moved out under pressure. Lots of them left without any form of compensation because they couldn't handle the fear and the bullying from the owners anymore.
Mr. Svinka denies those allegations, but the Prague City Council has now become involved, saying it will help to find new homes for the five remaining families living in the building, and at least one councillor is demanding that Mikhail Kotsab pays for them. Indeed, his involvement in the whole affair has sparked considerable anger on the council. Another councillor, Rudolf Blažek, said he understood that squatting was an inescapable reality of urban life, but for the state, represented by Minister Kotsab, to help them find free accommodation was simply unacceptable. The Milada story is rapidly becoming a political affair, in other words, but it still speaks volumes about the transformation of Prague from the exciting, unconventional, sometimes even anarchic city of the early post-communist years to the prosperous, sedate, some would even say boring European capital of 2009, with its banks, insurance offices and luxury new apartments. There's certainly little room in this modern materialist society for those who refuse to live by its rules.
Rob Cameron with that report. The Czech Republic, like any Western country, may be inundated with American cinema, but just when you think you've seen it all, the US shows it has some more surprises. And if you're going to see them anywhere, then it's going to be in Karlovy Vary, where the 44th International Film Festival is currently taking place. This week, one of those surprises was a film and a director who's breathed new life into the inimitably American film genre of blaxploitation. Christine Falvey reports from Karlovy Vary.
While Festival Week started out with the Czech classics and the French cinéaste, attention soon took a sharp turn towards a newfangled talent of the American screen. The talk of the town was one Scott Sanders, parodist extraordinaire. After stunning Sundance earlier this year, he is now turning heads in Europe too. His film, Black Dynamite, was a wholly unexpected treat, a brilliant take on American blaxploitation film that's wowing Europeans with a genre they don't know well and a whole new level of ridiculousness that was not entirely lost in translation.
All you suckers gather round. There's a brand new movie coming to town. So get on up and check the scene of the smoothest, baddest mother to ever hit the big screen. Dynamite!
Dynamite! It seems like there are a couple of jokes that people here didn't get, but that's because they're really local jokes. Like there's a joke about a restaurant in Los Angeles. Nobody gets that joke here, or like in, you know, in Germany. But I mean, for the most part, I mean, even jokes that they don't get there, they get here. So that was interesting too. It's been a big surprise to me that the movie has done well in festivals, and now festivals that aren't based in English.
And the film was not the only surprise. After midnight, the truly mild-mannered Scott Sanders became DJ Sucker Punch at one of the week's most anticipated parties. He did not disappoint. The 1970s blaxploitation films were attempts at wooing black audiences by offering them a tailor-made movie land it was hoped they would relate to. It means big guns, big cars, a ghetto milieu, pimps and dealers, and a suspicion of whites and the government. Hence a barrage of stereotypes, often deemed insulting in the 1970s, but today so preposterous as to be utterly hilarious. While director Quentin Tarantino gave Europe a taste of the blaxploitation experience, Sanders may be the first to find success abroad with the unadulterated recipe.
More than blaxploitation, I think the movie is about movie conventions. And that's what kind of blaxploitation was, because it's like they're putting, you know, a black person in a situation and interpreting it in a way that exposes the movie conventions. So that the fact there's like a bullet and there's a sting on the bullet, you know, a musical sting on the bullet and everything. It's like that you're supposed to feel some emotion for that or something. Maybe that's why people laugh. Because I think it's, especially here, it's probably a very film-savvy audience. Even though they haven't seen blaxploitation movies, they've seen a lot of movies. And especially a lot of movies, you know, that have sort of corny plot devices, you know.
Sanders seemed to absorb as much novelty as he provided in Karlovy Vary. In addition to presenting his film, DJing the town's best club, and participating in the festival's masterclass discussions, he seemed to be everywhere in town at once. It is, he says, his first trip outside North America, and he says this visit to the Czech Republic won't be his last.
It's been fun. I mean, it's amazing. It's such a huge festival. It's such a, like, this is like the fanciest festival we've been in, you know, like in terms of just grand. So I want to come back here. I'm going to try to come back here for the premiere of the movie. This is a great country. Having a good time.
That was Scott Sanders ending that report by Christine Falvey, Radio Prague's own man amongst the movie stars at this year's Karlovy Vary Festival. And film-loving listeners should tune in on Friday for a special edition of The Arts, rounding up all of the Karlovy Vary action. That's to be listened out for, but now it's time for some news from the world of sport. The head of the Czech FA, Ivan Hašek, announced on Tuesday he was taking an unusual, but he said necessary step. In addition to his current responsibilities, he's to head the national football squad. The team has floundered so far in its World Cup qualifying campaign and is now at risk of failing to make the tournament in South Africa next year, unless someone turns its fortunes around. It's hoped that Hašek, a highly respected former player and coach, could be the right man for the job. Jan Wellinger has the details.
It probably wasn't the solution Ivan Hašek wanted, but it was a decision that had to be taken. Someone had to take responsibility for the troubled Czech team to give it a fighting chance of reaching next year's World Cup. On Tuesday, the recently elected head of the Czech FA announced he would take on the additional responsibility of leading the team, an unprecedented move he described as necessary under the circumstances. The reason? Other suitable candidates for the job were too few and far between, not least after Slavia coach Karel Jarolím turned him down. On the other hand, few could be arguably as qualified as Hašek himself, who has promised to lead the team only through qualification. The Czechs will have a new coach in 2010. A little earlier I spoke to Filip Sajfer, who writes for Czech daily Mladá Fronta Dnes. Here's how he assessed the FA head's decision.
Certainly it's an unusual move for him to both coach the team and head the FA. On the other hand, I can't think of a better solution, especially after Yaralim turned Hašek's offer down. It's certainly a risk. On the other hand, he has a lot of support among players and the league. He has their respect and is capable of turning things around.
As a player, Hašek earned 56 caps for the national squad. He even captained Czechoslovakia in the 1990 World Cup. Later, he led Sparta Prague to two league titles, so he is familiar with both success and pressure. He also won't be alone in running the Czech team, announcing on Tuesday several assistants, as well as a new advisor and former coach Karel Brückner. He led the Czechs in their phenomenal run at Euro 2004, and his addition on the team won't hurt, Filip Seifer says.
The addition of Karel Brückner was important. He was involved with the team in the past, and I don't think anyone can doubt he is capable of raising morale.
World Cup qualification will continue in the autumn, and according to Filip Seifer, the Czechs will have a realistic chance of qualifying if they can win all four remaining matches. One advantage for the Czechs is that their group, there is no real runaway leader. The Slovaks are currently first, but the Czechs can still come back if they redouble their efforts. Slovakia in September will be coach Hašek's first big test.
Jan Velinger there with news of Ivan Hašek taking over the reins of the Czech national team. And we'll see if Hašek's coaching can assure the Czechs a place in next year's World Cup in South Africa. Držíme palce. You're listening to Radio Prague, where in the last part of our show today, it's time for Czechs in History, with Chris Johnston profiling one of the architects of the 1948 communist takeover of Czechoslovakia, Rudolf Slánský.
Czechoslovak top communist Rudolf Slánský is a tragic figure of 20th century history in the classical sense of the word. In the end, the fate of the once powerful and self-made man was mapped out elsewhere. Slánský rose to the top of the Czechoslovak Communist Party and played a key part in its seizure of power in February 1948. For some periods before and after the takeover, he was probably more important than party leader Clement Gottwald, who was increasingly hitting the bottle for alcoholic consolation. But at the height of his power, Slánský was toppled by Soviet leader Joseph Stalin's paranoid search for scapegoats and purge victims. The repressive state machinery which Slánský had helped put in place in communist Czechoslovakia was turned against one of its creators. Historians have already pieced together the story of the Slánský show trial, the most shocking event to hit the Communist Party in power up till then. Some say the party never really recovered from the revelation that such a trusted and top-placed party member could have been a conspirator for the imperialist, Titoist and Zionist enemies of the time. But in spite of the recent historical spadework, many questions still remain. Why, for example, was Slánský in particular picked out for sacrifice after such an exemplary record serving the party? Igor Lukesh is Professor of International Relations and History at Boston University and has researched and written about Slánský's trial and execution.
The fact that Slánský was chosen has really no rational explanation. He was, of course, a completely devoted Stalinist from his earliest moments in politics, from the early 1920s when the party came into existence. He was eager and willing to simply emulate the line that came from Moscow.
He thinks that Stalin's clear belief in the Machiavellian principle that a prince should be feared rather than loved probably played a big part in deciding Slansky's fate.
It in fact seems to me that Slánský may have been chosen precisely because he was so loyal to Stalin, because in killing him, Stalin's message to the rest of Eastern Europe leadership was, if he can die, if he is not safe, then nobody is. Perhaps the main reason of the main motivation behind this and other similar show trials that swept across Eastern Europe was to terrorize the East European communist bosses into absolute and total submission.
Rudolf Slansky was born in the village of Niewiestice, south of Pilsen, in 1901. A talented student, he moved to the capital Prague to continue his studies, but in the turbulent years following the creation of the new Czechoslovakia and evolving Russian Revolution, he was increasingly sidetracked by politics. As a 20-year-old in 1921, he was one of the founder members of the Communist Party. From 1924, he was a journalist on party papers, getting his proletarian baptism in the coal and steel city of Ostrava, where he became party regional secretary. It was also in Ostrava that his friendship developed with future party leader Clement Gottwald. When Gottwald seized power from the old party guard in 1929, Slansky was also one of the main beneficiaries. He was appointed to the new Central Committee and Politburo and became party secretary for Prague. But it was not all smooth sailing. The Communist Party was banned at the time, and Slansky's attempts to build up its underground network got him into trouble more than once with Moscow. In 1935, he was banished from the top party echelons for not promoting a strong enough common front against fascism. He took the criticism badly, but was back at the top a year later. In the aftermath of Munich in 1938, Slansky, like other Czechoslovak party leaders, fled to Moscow. Like other exiles, Slansky and his family were housed in the famous Hotel Lux, where Stalin's secret police made nightly selections of who would be purged. Historian Igor Lukesh.
The NKVD arrested on a daily or rather nightly basis. And the people who lived there, this is well attested to by many participants, essentially could not sleep through the night because you could hear the arresting teams spreading through the building, and all you could do really was just to listen for the steps, whether they would stop in front of your door or whether that very night they would still stop at somebody else's door. I think these people went through absolute horror.
The Nazi attack on the Soviet Union was a relief for the Czech communist exiles because it curbed the purges. After taking part in the Slovak national uprising in mid-1944 and a grueling escape across the mountains to evade the Nazis, Slansky returned to Czechoslovakia on the heels of the victorious Red Army. The party was riding a popular wave, and Slansky was at the top of that wave as the second most powerful man after Gottwald. Slansky's task as party general secretary was to build the party at home. As its membership soared and its influence developed, so did that of the general secretary. He picked most of the regional party leaders himself and became a central figure as it prepared to infiltrate and sabotage democratic parties and make a bid for power. In the run-up to February 1948, Slansky's managerial and organisational genius and Gottwald's sporadic failure to manage his alcoholism meant he was at the zenith of his power. Igor Lukesh.
Perhaps in the period 45-48, he may have been, on occasion, perhaps even more important than Gottwald himself, who became more and more dependent on alcohol and at times became nothing but a simple drunk. And it was therefore up to Slansky to prepare the party for the final confrontation with the democratic, with its democratic rivals. And it was Slansky who I think proved more than once in the period from 45 to 48 that he was in fact brilliant, if I can put it in quotation marks, a brilliant tactician.
Once in power, the party increasingly sought to have its say in running the country. Over time, this put it on a collision course with the new communist ministers in government and made the normally friendless Slansky even more enemies. He still, however, had his trump card, his close friendship with Gottwald. The real threat, however, came from Moscow and Stalin's real or artificial conviction that the new communist regimes of Central and Eastern Europe were being undermined from within by top party officials. The first attempt to weed out a conspiracy at first cast Slansky, together with Gottwald, as a victim. But during the early months of 1951, his role began to be redrafted by the imported Soviet investigators as the mastermind of an anti-state conspiracy.
If you actually look at the period of, let's say, the last year and a half of Slansky's life, you discover that there had been more than one occasion when Stalin demanded harsh measures to be applied against Slansky, and he demanded it of Gottwald. And Gottwald surprisingly resisted. I think that if there is one episode in this story, it is how long Gottwald had resisted the pressure that came from Moscow for Slansky's arrest and his demise and destruction.
The pressure building up for that arrest probably became irresistible when a letter implicating Slansky as a Western agent, or the so-called Great Sweeper, was intercepted. It was a plant by an agent working for exiled Czechoslovak anti-communist intelligence chief František Moravec. The arrest followed 2 weeks later after Slansky returned to his Prague villa from a reception. The process then began of moulding Slansky's testimony for the show trial that was to be prepared. Here, unlike many of his colleagues, he resisted for a long time and narrowly failed to take his own life in prison.
He, in fact, behaved in a rather courageous way. He confessed only to things that had been already confessed to by his colleagues, and he tried as hard as he could not to implicate unnecessarily others.
Trial sparked a wave of anti-Jewish hatred. Slansky and most of his alleged fellow conspirators were Jewish. He was hanged on December 3, 1952, at Prague's Pankratz prison.
That was Chris Johnstone with that edition of Czechs in History, and that's all we've got time for today here on Radio Prague. So from myself, Rosie Johnston, and the rest of the team here in Prague, it's thanks for listening, and goodbye.